A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio. The world has been turned on its head again this morning, ladies and gentlemen, as we learn that the police watchdog is now investigating two Metropolitan Police officers who responded to the terrorist attack in Streatham last month as they rushed to the scene of a crazed Islamic terrorist who was stabbing random strangers in the street, having been released early despite having been warned that he was quite dangerous. They managed to crash the car they were in. Now they face months of uncertainty and could lose their jobs as a result of the action by the Independent Office for Police Conduct, who have accused them both of gross misconduct and dangerous driving. The Police Federation are calling the threat that they could both lose their jobs as an absolute joke, and it surely is that at the very least. It's a very bad joke, whoever thought this one up. We'll hear from the Metropolitan Police Federation Chairman, Ken Marsh, who's not happy about this at all. I'm not happy about it either. After all, what sort of message is this sending to anybody who wants to be recruited into the police force, or the police service as it is now called, and what sort of interesting measurements are they going to be handing out to people who are in the anti-terror squads, the people who we quite rightly have praised to the high heavens for their rapid responses to anything that happens from London Bridge to Streatham and many points in between. 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we'll take you live to Downing Street, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to reveal a four-point plan to deal with the latest on the coronavirus situation, as more and more flights are cancelled, shutdowns of business are looking more and more likely, and supermarket shelves are getting emptied by crazy people who think it's a great idea to stockpile everything just in case. Also, we'll bring you the latest on the Priti Patel bullying accusations after it was revealed that someone who once worked for her took an overdose because of how she was spoken to. However, it does turn out that she'd previously taken an overdose as well, so it would seem that the smear campaign against the Home Secretary is still ongoing. 0344 499 1000. Don't forget, we're now live streaming the show on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter as well, so you can watch us as well as listening to us. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station in the world. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it beggars belief sometimes when you get the idea that people who run things in this country run them in the way that they do. And one of the things that absolutely staggered me this morning was when I discovered that not only are two police officers under suspension and looking at possibly the wrong end of the unemployment queue, but they've been basically investigated by the Police Conduct Authority, the Independent Office for Police Conduct, I should say, because they crashed a car while they were rushing to try and get to a terrorist attack before anybody was killed. And thanks to the speed with which the rapid response units in the police force now operate, we've actually seen lots of lives being saved. So we're going to talk to Ken Marsh now, the Metropolitan Police Federation Chairman, because I think he will be as astonished as you all are listening to this morning, because the situation is this. They were rushing on a Sunday afternoon through busy streets in South London because Sudesh Aman had been released from prison. He was so dangerous that he was being followed and trailed by other police officers, and he suddenly realised that he was being followed, and it seems he then took it upon himself to rush into a shop, if you remember the story, grab a knife and just start stabbing people at random. Ken, a very good morning to you. Welcome to the show.
Morning, Mike.
Thanks very much for joining us. This is quite remarkable, isn't it?
It is. In my service, I've been with the police a long time. I've not encountered this one, and I'm really, really frustrated by it. And I'll tell you why. There's been quite a bit thrown back at us around, well, you're police, you should be investigating. I have no issue with that whatsoever. Absolutely. As police officers, we should be transparent. We should be investigated. But gross misconduct?
Mm.
Come on, let's have a bit of common sense here. Firstly, the two vehicles that were going to the scene, bear in mind, walk that mile with me just for a minute. Radios are going off everywhere. Officers are running from all over London. Mm. This is a major terrorist incident. We don't know it's one person. Could be 10, 15, 20.
Right.
Further, the officer that had the interaction with the vehicle, how do you not know that was a bandit vehicle doing that on purpose?
Yeah.
Right, so the second vehicle carries on, because the second vehicle, funny enough, is trained for that sort of thing.
Yes.
So they leave the scene. Bang, you're in trouble and you're on gross misconduct. Come on. Please.
I mean, it really is. As you say, presumably these pen pushers, the people that sit behind the desks, don't know what it's like in that car. They don't understand what it's like to drive at high speed through fairly narrow streets, covered in parked cars, cars coming at you from all sorts of directions, speed bumps all over the place. I mean, it's bad enough when you're not trying to get to a terrorist attack.
Yeah. Well, but look, listen, as police officers, if you're I was trained in blue light.
Yeah.
You're trained to all sorts of levels. The training is very intense. It's very pressurised. And quite rightly, it's so that you are competent and have the ability to do what you're doing. So, therefore, when an officer has an accident, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
Treat it as an accident and say, as the Prime Minister said and as the Home Secretary said, well done for getting there so quickly.
Mm.
Now, the rub on this, Mike, is if you want my colleagues to drive at 30 miles per hour, obey them and hear everything on the way, well, God forbid what will happen then in terms of deaths to the public.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things I have said and have said repeatedly ever since the first London Bridge attack in Borough Market and the most recent one last November, the speed with which the Metropolitan Police armed response units now get to these events is quite incredible. They're really good at it, you know, because you don't know exactly where they are when it happens, but they seem to be able to get... Certainly to the London Bridge attack, they were there within about 2 or 3 minutes, which is amazing.
Absolutely. And you know, if we're going to start saying to my colleagues, stop, think, that's very worrying.
Yeah.
My colleagues don't think in that sort of situation about what speed they're doing. They react. They respond. They run to danger.
Yes.
That's what you want them to do. That's what the public want them to do. I'll tell you what, Mike, if you saw the amount of emails and letters we received into my office yesterday from members of public, just Joe Public, saying, good on you, this is absolutely disgusting.
Yes. It really is quite incredible. But who's behind this kind of decision to do this? Because I think we should be told, because we've seen, for example, and I know this is none of your business and not related at all, but we've seen how some people inside the civil service operate when nobody's keeping an eye on them. Who's responsible for coming up with this stuff?
Well, this has to get automatically referred by the Met.
Right.
So I accept that. I understand that fully. That is policy. So the Met would automatically refer it to the IOPC.
Mm.
Then they become very faceless. You don't get names as to who's done this.
Right.
You just get officers summons to buildings to be served notices. So there is a lack of transparency around that, because I have a very good professional standards lead within the Federation, Ollie Cochrane, who is just brilliant. And if you have a conversation with him, he would have guided them through and he would have told them, you know, how we can take this forward, how the investigation can be done so there's transparency, etc., etc. Because these cops are human beings.
Mm.
How do they feel now after being patted on the back by the Prime Minister and having to wallow around the next couple of years waiting for a result on this?
Well, that's the other question I was going to have for you, is what is the procedure now? Where are these two guys? I know we can't name them, but that's fair enough. But what is it that happens to them once they've been sort of tapped on the shoulder, as it were? Are they put on restricted duty? Are they suspended? What's going on?
So they're restricted from driving completely,
right.
Which will have a detrimental effect on the role they can perform, because they're specialists in certain areas.
So that's two less anti-terror police on the streets?
Well, I haven't said they're not on the streets. They could still perform a role.
Yeah.
But what's their mindset?
Right.
Knowing that this is facing them, gross misconduct, you know. Put yourself in those shoes. You've got a mortgage, you've got children, etc., etc. You're a human being and you've been stumped with this.
Right.
I'm not sure you'd want to be carrying guns around the street and behaving how they do.
Well, and putting your life on the line, basically, for an organisation that clearly doesn't care about you. I mean, with all due respect to the Federation, I'm talking about the actual Metropolitan Police. And also, why does it have to take such a long time?
You tell me, Mike, please, hallelujah. We've raised this over and over again so many times. You wouldn't be able to treat a member of public the way we're treated.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Mm.
They just think they can do whatever they want, take as long as they want. How does it take a year, 2 years, to do an investigation. Yeah. You could investigate this in a fortnight.
Well, exactly. I mean, surely you could do it in a week if you had to. I mean, it seems to me to be incredible.
I'll give them a fortnight to give them a bit of credence, yeah?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've got to take their holiday time in between, of course, haven't they? So, I mean, and also, what does this do, not just to the morale of the two individuals concerned, but to the rest of the squad, to the rest of the armed response people, because it could be them next.
Yeah, well, we've been in close contact with them, as you would expect, and they're absolutely disgusted by it. It has a knock-on effect. It knocks on to them, because then they start thinking now, the next call that comes out tomorrow afternoon, major incident, you know, are they thinking differently as to how they're going to respond? It has a knock-on to people thinking within other departments to apply for that department. It has a knock-on for new recruits that we're desperately trying to sign up across the country. You know, the ramifications are massive.
Yeah. And do you represent these guys, Ken, as per when they go and appear in front of whatever committee they have to go and appear in front of?
We do. I don't personally, I'm the chairman, but we have experts who are police officers, who are full-time Fed reps, etc., who that is their role and their specialist. But they have legal support as well. You know, they have a real good team around them that will support them from beginning to end.
Right. And do they have a definition of this gross misconduct? Because surely, I can't imagine under which circumstance they could find even a reason to accuse them of that.
No, it's quite bizarre. And this is what I've been really getting the ump about, because, you know, I say it again, no issue with investigation, but by lumping gross misconduct on it, that's a sackable offence.
Yeah.
Once you get to that level, that's the highest level you can put on an officer.
Right.
You know, and that carries all sorts of caveats within it, and it gives the remit for removal from employment.
Mm.
Well, it doesn't need to be that. It needs to be a full investigation is taking place. We fully accept that. The officers have been made aware of that. We fully accept that, the outcome. And then if there is a finding that has a detrimental effect on the actions of the officer, then that will be discussed.
Right.
But to bang this out to them from day one, bang, have a bit of that, when they've not even done a preliminary investigation.
Right. Because we thought in the public, I'd have to say, that the things had taken a bit of a turn for the better now that Boris Johnson was in charge, because we understood that, you know, your guys have been given the right to shoot to kill if, in fact, it turns out that one of these terrorist scumbags looks as if he's wearing a vest of some description, a suicide vest, even if it's fake. And I thought, well, that sounds sensible to me. But do they still investigate people every time they fire a gun as well?
Yeah, but this isn't the government. The IOPC is meant to be independent in what they do. Yes, they still do full investigations of everything, but turn around very quickly.
Yeah.
Because so if you saw the London Bridge, you saw Westminster, those officers have been dealt with, you know, because it's been turned around.
Yes.
Because the remit has come from the government, that's the way it will be. Well, we need to understand or have some sort of understanding around how we're going to treat our heroes when you want them to run towards horrendous terrorists.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Exactly, and as you say, you don't know if you're in that car, whether it's a bomb you're going to, whether it's a guy with a suicide vest, whether it's a sort of Bataclan situation with five guys with machine guns. You just don't know, do you?
Not a clue. And you know, the whole thing about this is, and I speak to firearms officers a lot, there is a heightened perception now, you know, and I'm not creating hysteria or ramping it up by saying that. Within armed officers, there is a heightened perception. So that means at any given time, you could be called upon to pull that trigger. Now, just put yourself in that mindset. Mm. You are a human being who has the ability, under lawful order, to take someone's life.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to be in that position, and I take my hat off to our colleagues that are.
Yes.
But we have to afford them some, you know, recompense, some responsibility to what they're doing and admire them for that, rather than jump on them when you've had several hours to sit down and just mull over things that they're making 0.1 of a second decisions on.
Exactly right. And as you said, nobody's objecting to an investigation.
No.
Nobody's saying you can't look into what happened and learn lessons from it. But what you don't want to do, as you say, is put them in a mindset now, which is very negative, which is incredibly sort of depressed, no doubt, when they've got the opportunity to or the possibility of having to take another life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's the basis of what we're talking about.
Right.
The public have started to really understand what the police are about and what we're doing and what we're trying to do, because when you're in fear and when you're in danger, you look to the police.
Yes.
And because we've had numerous terrorist attacks, and unfortunately, I have to say, we will probably have more, You know, well, then it's down to us. We're your line of blue that will sort it out. So if you want to start restricting how we're doing that and you want to start jumping all over us before an investigation has even been done, then we've got a problem.
Yeah, we absolutely have. Is there anything you can do at this moment to kind of reduce the charge, as it were?
Well, we've obviously lobbied very hard over the last 24 hours, 48 hours. We are being listened to. This will be looked at more closely now, I would suggest. I have to say from the off, it's absurd. I don't think anything will come from it at all, because good luck if you're going to find my colleagues guilty of of something out of this, because yeah. I've looked at it, my colleagues have looked at it. No, I can't see that happening.
What do you think would be the sort of effect on recruitment and also the kind of general wherewithal and the morale of the armed response units if these two guys get found guilty of this?
I wouldn't like to say, but I think it will have a detrimental effect on the behaviour of my armed colleagues and the way they respond to serious incidents, and that is terrible. I don't like talking like that as a police officer, because we're here to protect you, we're here to look after you, we're here to run towards it, and that's what I do, and that's what I have running through my veins and yeah. all my other colleagues.
Yes, exactly right. Well, listen, Ken, I wish them both luck. If you see them for me, I wish them luck on behalf of all the people listening to this show as well, because we do not want to see this happening, and we do not think they deserve it. Thanks very much indeed. Ken Marsh from the Metropolitan Police Federation, absolutely steaming mad, and quite rightly so, because this is what a spokesman for the Independent Office for Police Conduct said. On Friday, February the 28th, we served notices of investigation for dangerous driving and gross misconduct on the officer driving the vehicle involved in the collision and on the driver of a marked police vehicle, which was in close proximity to the unmarked vehicle. A criminal investigation does not mean that criminal charges will necessarily follow. Oh, well, that's nice. So now they may be found guilty of some kind of a crime. Misconduct notices do not imply guilt. Such notices are not judgmental in any way. Well, let me tell you something, mate. They are very judgmental, because what you're basically telling us is that a guy who's driving at high speed to a terrorist attack, which is ongoing, in order to save some people's lives, in order that these people wouldn't be stabbed by some crazed maniac who was let out of jail too early, even though the police said he was dangerous. Well, I think he should be driving probably quite fast, and he probably should be driving in a risky manner. But that's why he's trained to do that. And occasionally things go wrong. Occasionally you're going to have the odd collision. It doesn't mean that you should take these guys down and start charging them with crimes and start insinuating that they might lose their jobs. It's an absolute and utter disgrace. And I want to hear from you on this, please. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Don't forget, we're live streaming on YouTube as well. You can watch us as well as listening to us here on Talk Radio. We'll come back with your calls next.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Lots more for us to do throughout the course of the day. Coming up at around about 10:30, we expect to hear from Boris Johnson at Downing Street. He's going to be giving us his four-point plan. There's an awful lot of talk and back talk going on around the coronavirus outbreak about what Britain is about to do, what Britain may be prepared to do, what shops are prepared to do, what organisations are prepared to do. There's an awful lot of traffic down in terms of airport flights and all of that. We'll be talking to Simon Calder later on in the show about that as well. But let's go at the phones now and talk about this police situation, which is quite frankly ludicrous. I've just spoken to Ken Marsh, who's the chairman of the Metropolitan Police Federation. He is absolutely hopping mad, quite rightly, that two very, very brave individuals, two anti-terror police, are now being investigated for gross misconduct, which could lead to them losing their jobs. Simon is in Orpington. Hello, Simon.
Mike, good morning.
Morning.
And we're going to have a ding-dong this morning, I'm afraid.
Yeah, go on.
Look, I think you're wrong. I think if there's been an accident, it has to be investigated. That's the procedures that the police have in place.
Yeah, there's no argument about that, though. There's no argument about the investigation.
I understand that. But if they feel there's reason to take it further, then again, they have to take it further. Now, Mike, what you've got here is a couple of members of the public who were injured by the police car. Now, if that was your family member who was injured, and maybe there was evidence or suspicion that the police were tweeting or texting or something like that and not paying attention, surely you would at least want that investigated so you knew.
Well, the fact is, they can do an investigation, they can get these people in front of a panel of experts, if that's what they wish to do, but what they don't have to do is charge them with gross misconduct. It's all very well saying, you know, this does not in any way reflect on their guilt, but it's a bit like saying, if I charge you with some kind of, assault, even though you weren't guilty of it, then that's not going to have any effect on your reputation in the wider world. as police officers, they are in dangerous situations. They're not in ordinary jobs. They're not, you know, driving instructors. If they happen to have an incident while they're driving at high speed towards a terrorist attack because they're trying to save lives, they should be treated slightly differently than the way you and I are treated, shouldn't they?
Look, perhaps, but if you're saying, hang on, if you're saying that there was evidence for gross misconduct, but then you're saying you think they should overlook that, well, why should they overlook
it? Well, who's saying there is evidence, though?
Yeah, but
who's saying that?
Well, that's what the investigation will find out.
Well, surely
Mike,
you then do
you
the...
Don't have that,
well, hang on, don't you do the... Hey, no, hang on, don't you do the investigation and then decide whether to charge them with misconduct?
Well, if they've got to a place of actually making the charge, then obviously they feel there's reason to put the charge in place. They wouldn't do it just for the sake of it.
Are you sure?
We have to understand. Yeah, but we need to know that when police are going to any form of incidents, they are travelling there in the safest manner possible. I understand. I mean, you say their job is to take risks. No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
The job.
I'm
no,
sorry.
Mike,
no.
Job.
Oh, how would
hang
you
on,
like
Mike.
It, right? If you, if you,
back.
Hang on, wait a second. Wait, no, just wait one
All
second,
right.
Simon. If you're getting stabbed on London Bridge, you don't care if the guy's stopping for a red light to save you, do you?
Well, the rules of the police is they never know what they're attending when they're going there exactly. And by the time they get there, the position has changed anyway. So therefore, the enemy to a police going on the way to the instrument is red mist. And that's when the danger kicks in.
That's rubbish.
That's what
You're
they're
talking
training.
Absolute no, rubbish, Simon. I'm sorry. Absolute cobblers. But I'd like to talk to you some more about it, but I've got to run. So call me back and we'll talk later.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Don't forget we are live streaming on YouTube now as well as on Facebook and on Twitter, so you can watch us as well as listening to us. We've got lots coming up in the next hour. We're going to be talking to Simon Calder, who is, of course, our travel guru from the Independent. He's going to be telling us precisely what is going on out there in the big wide world, because an awful lot of airlines are cancelling flights. A lot of airlines are stopping flying to certain destinations, and it's going to be only a matter of time, I would have thought, before some of them start to really, really feel the pinch economically. And if you're travelling anywhere, you want to listen to it because, of course, what British Airways have suggested they're going to do is they're going to allow people to change the dates of their flights if, in fact, they need to go some other time because they can't go at the moment. But what I'm saying is I'm not sure people want to book flights at the moment because it's not very clear what the state of the world is going to be in the coming weeks and months. I'm not suggesting there's any reason to be alarmed. It's just that, you know, the measures that might be taken by certain countries or by certain governments, including our own, might make it difficult for people to travel. One of the other side effects, of course, of the coronavirus outbreak is that supermarkets are now hit by panic buying. Tesco's have said that, you know, if there is a major outbreak in this country, there might be empty shelves and food riots. Ocado has emailed customers to warn them that it's running out of home delivery slots due to exceptionally high demand. What is going on out there? We thought rather than talking to some shopping executives, we'd talk to somebody who could tell us about the psychology of all of this. And Honey Lancaster-James joins us now. Honey, very good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning. You're not too panic-stricken then to come into work today?
Well, I'm not, no. I mean, I'm not one for panicking, generally speaking. I'm also not one for hoarding stuff. I've never really been someone that does that, you know. I always assume that, you know, it's never going to be as bad as people say it's going to be. But what is this kind of obsession that people seem to have in this country with hoarding? I mean, if somebody said to you or somebody announced on the news there's going to be a fuel shortage, the next thing, you go out and everybody's queuing up for petrol.
Yes, that's right. I mean, first of all, just to say, this is a normal behaviour. Hoarding behaviour, and especially at times of stress and insecurity, is a very normal and adaptive response.
Right.
If you think about, you know, primitive man, you know, it would have made sense if you think that there might be an impending shortage or difficulty for you getting supplies. It makes absolutely adaptive sense to want to hoard. The question really is whether that is actually warranted. And sometimes what we have is a situation where some of our old kind of fear responses, if you like, are left over from times when we perhaps did need to listen to them, and now they sort of they kind of impact upon us even perhaps when it's not necessary.
Right.
So one of the things, you know, we often talk about is how the body and the brain respond to threat in the same way as if a lion's coming towards you. Your sort of limbic system, your kind of primitive brain, if you like, responds as if you're under threat, and even if it's perhaps just an impending exam or something else. And I think it's similar when it comes to these kind of panics. Some people would say that they're just taking precautions about not necessarily worrying that they're not going to be able to leave the house, but worrying that there might be a shortage because other people are panic buying. And of course, what happens is it becomes a bit of a bandwagon. We call it the bandwagon effect. You only need to see one other person queuing up and trying to get things. And that makes you think, well, hang on, if everybody does that, then there will be a shortage. So I want to get in there. And of course, it creates this snowball effect.
Well, that's kind of how the fuel shortages happen, isn't it? Because people go and buy petrol and then suddenly there isn't any.
That's right. It's the fear of the shortage that actually then creates the shortage, if you like.
Right.
So that is a bit of a problem. I mean, I think this whole thing with the coronavirus, ultimately, you know, it is right that we're getting the appropriate sort of health advice and things that we need to do. And it is all about washing your hands and observing sensible things like coughing and sneezing into a tissue and then discarding the tissue, you know, from a medical point of view. But one of the things that interests me as a psychologist is that we're also seeing the sort of facts and figures, the scientific evidence that suggests that this is actually much less threatening than the sort of the more common strains of flu that we have to deal with anyway.
I've been saying to people, honey, since this really became a big story, I suppose, about a week or two ago, it's the effect of the virus more than the virus itself which is causing the problem, really.
I mean, obviously, I'm not a doctor and I'm not, you know, therefore medically qualified. But, I mean, it is alarming when you see, I think, constant sort of news coverage of people walking around in masks and constant news coverage about things like the cruise liner that was under lockdown and now the flights and things like that. Obviously, that makes people think, well, hang on, this must be a real threat. This must be a lot more dangerous than normal flu because otherwise people wouldn't be shutting things down. But actually, what happens is it can be a bit of a domino effect. And there might be an issue in one place, you know, perhaps in China or Japan or whatever, and certain things start to be locked down to cope with it there. And that then sort of has this global effect because of the way that news spreads globally. And so it can magnify the sense of threat. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be taking precautions to just wash hands and do all the normal things we should do anyway if we've got germs or we're coughing and spluttering. We should be doing that, of course. But I think we do need to be careful not to panic and not to confuse sort of news coverage with being an indication of actual level of threat. Because by my understanding, and again, being very careful to point out that I'm not a doctor, the evidence that I've read suggests that actually this is less threatening than flu, ordinary flu. And we don't go around sort of stopping flights and closing things down and stockpiling from the supermarket every winter because flu comes back around.
No, we don't. But I suppose part of the problem here is that this is a sort of an unknown virus in the sense that it's spreading in a way that they know that flu doesn't spread. I mean, because flu is something which only really is dangerous to a relatively small number of people, as is this. But I think the trouble is they still don't really know enough. And I think that's where there's a problem because, you know, potentially if they allow it to go, I mean, I sort of have two points of view here. If they were sure that it's not that dangerous, they could probably just say to people, look, it's not really going to be a problem for most people. So we're going to just try and contain it and do our best. But if loads of people get it, so be it. But they can't really say that, can they? Because that sounds a little bit bit cavalier.
Yes, but of course, and also one of the problems is that once this has been sort of publicised on the international stage, as it has, then it takes, you know, one person getting very, very sick or, you know, one person tragically dying, and that then makes the news now because it's a story about coronavirus. Whereas very sadly, the honest truth is that a number of people die each year from the flu and from other infectious diseases. And that doesn't make the news because, if you like, that's not on the back of that news story. So I think that's one of the difficulties we have with the way we consume media nowadays. Once something has been made into a story, then we seek to sort of confirm that story and further that story by looking for evidence that goes along with that story. And unfortunately, we then sort of ignore all the things that are counter from that. So I think that's a danger here. danger. It's a danger in the way that we have such rapid sharing of news around the globe, that something that could be relatively well contained or relatively well managed in one area then creates a sort of international panic.
Yes. And do you think there's a sort of a human comfort blanket, I suppose you might say, if there is a house full of stuff, you know, like if you have hoarded loads of cans of beans and you have hoarded, you know, loads of wet wipes and you've hoarded loads of hand gel, which I'm told, by the way, doesn't even work on coronavirus unless it's 60% alcohol. So if you've bought a load of that, you can't really, it's not really going to do you any good.
Yeah.
But people feel, I suppose, safer if they've got a big cupboard full of stuff.
Yes, well, I think there's two things there. I think one is around, you know, there are some people who will feel more safe and more secure if they have stockpiled for almost every eventuality. You know, there are some people who like to keep a back cupboard full of tins of whatever just in case anything happens, you know, flooding or anything else, or the car breaks down or whatever. So I think there are some people who have that kind of personality, if you like, where they prefer to be prepared for all eventualities. And I think it would undoubtedly make them feel more safe and secure to have that in place. And then I think there's another sort of psychological principle at play as well, which is around the element of control. And when, you know, when we feel insecure and when we feel a bit uncertain about outcomes, one of the things that can make us feel better is feeling like we can do something, that we are empowered, that we have a level of control. So even the sort of hand sanitizer thing that you mentioned, you know, even if it isn't particularly effective in some cases, if you've bought that sort of cheap stuff or you've got those kind of wet wipes or something, it can make you feel better thinking, well, there is something I can do. And it's just the feeling of control, the feeling of empowerment, the feeling of being able to do something that actually reduces your anxiety rather than the actual thing itself, if that makes sense.
Yes. So now the $64,000 question, have you stockpiled anything, honey?
I haven't yet, but now you're mentioning it. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? You know, funnily enough, I just got asked, actually, if I do some public speaking and I do some speaking on cruise ships sometimes. And I just got asked if I wanted to go on this cruise and do some talks. You know, the first thing that went through my head was, oh, but what about the virus?
Yeah.
But I suppose I was thinking more about things like, you know, is it going to be an issue where we won't be able to pull into a particular port and so we'll be on board longer? But actually, you know, I'm in my middle age. I'm relatively fit and healthy and well. And if I did get it, all the evidence suggests that I would be absolutely fine. I mean, I do worry a little bit about my elderly father who texted me yesterday and said that he had, you know, heavy cold symptoms. And I said, oh, Dad, you know, do you think you should phone? Of course, you know, I'm human, just like everybody else. We're going to worry about these things, but we have to look at the facts. And, you know, perhaps take some reassurance from that actually this was a big news story, and as a result, it's become a global news story.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you're under any more threat than you would be from the normal strains of flu. And in fact, I think the death rates for flu are much, much higher.
Yes, I think
so
they
are. Try not to panic.
Absolutely right. Well, very wise words, honey. Thank you very much indeed. Honey Lancaster James there on the psychology of hoarding. If you've been hoarding stuff, I'd love to know what it is that you're hoarding and why, because there's no need for it. I mean, despite the fact that Lidl say they are experiencing a significant increase in demand for durable products and disinfectants, it has now limited sales of hand sanitizer to 2 per customer. So effectively, they're rationing hand sanitizer because people are getting carried away thinking they have to buy it. And by the way, apparently, if it's not 60% alcohol, it doesn't work anyway on coronavirus. This is Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Well, even as we speak, I've just received an email in which it says, great news, we've released thousands of extra seats from £29. And that's Eurostar. Also, £35 to Amsterdam. Spring seats, they're saying, because basically, I don't think anyone's going anywhere. Let's talk to Simon Calder, our very favourite travel editor and travel guru. Simon, a very good afternoon to you.
Mike, so interesting to hear that you say that I'm going to tell you exactly what's happening in the airline business. Crikey, if only.
Well,
I mean, I can tell you, if you want to go to lovely Norway tomorrow, then it's going to cost you just over £44.
Really?
Yep, that's flying out of Stansted. Actually going to real Oslo on Ryanair, which is a change because they've got two other places they pretend are Oslo.
Oh, yeah.
So £44, obviously that's about the price of a beer in the Norwegian capital, but still nice to get away. And it just shows you what sort of ridiculous state the airline business is in. And I got the same email from Eurostar. Yep. They are suddenly selling fares, lots and lots and lots of seats at prices way below
could this also be the result of us leaving the European Union, and therefore there's no great cavalcade of bureaucrats going backwards and forwards to Brussels?
Oh yes, there's an awful lot of that, and there will be. It's not so much this year because we're still pretending we're in the European Union, and of course there's quite a lot of negotiators.
Sure,
but there's
nobody in the European Parliament anymore, so that must be saving quite a few journeys, obviously.
Oh sure, yes, absolutely. It was it's difficult times for Eurostar and for any other travel business. I think we're back now to where we were in 2001 in the dark days after the 9/11 attack. Some people have said it's like the economic collapse.
Yes.
A decade ago. I think it's worse than that.
Well, I think in terms of the travel business it is,
yes.
Because what we've got is a lot of people who just don't know what to do. They're not sure where to go. Not because anything's necessarily a problem. It's just that, you know, I was going to book a flight to New York to go and see my mother in April.
Yeah.
But I decided not to because I thought, I don't know for sure at the moment what the situation in April is going to be like. And then sure enough, the next day, British Airways cancels a load of flights to New York.
Yeah, and they're not doing that, of course, for health reasons. It's purely because they think that they're all going to be empty.
Yes.
And there's two cases here. The first one is, I've booked, and therefore, if I don't go, I'll lose some or all of my money. You should most certainly go. If the government will tell you if it's to an area which is regarded as too dangerous in terms of the coronavirus, and those are mainland China, the two regions of South Korea I've never heard of and certainly wouldn't be going to, and 11 no doubt delightful towns in northern Italy,
yes.
None of which is on the tourism trail. So
no, and Iran, of course, where not a lot of people want to go anyway.
So there's those locations, but
I think the worry though is, Simon, and I think it's not about so much people who are obviously not going to be going to those types of places anyway. The worry is that if you book a flight now to go somewhere in April or May, it may well be by April and May, one of those destinations might be on that list.
Oh, sure. And look, I would predict that your trip to New York will go ahead absolutely normally, but I don't know for sure. And so, therefore, if you're looking at future bookings, really any time at all, I would just hold off
just
until
wait,
a little
bit. Well,
beforehand.
We had a look this morning on the BA website, and you can fly to New York return at the moment, today, for about £270.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's a great time to be a traveller. And the prices will go up. There will be a stage, I again predict, at which we will say collectively, actually, we're kind of getting used to this now. We want a bit of sun, we want a bit of excitement, and we'll start travelling again.
Yes.
But otherwise, just do it on a sort of short-term book in advance.
I mean, I know that you haven't got a crystal ball, and I know that you probably have not got a sort of insider knowledge of the finances of any of these companies, but it can't be doing them any good in terms of running an airline where you're expected. I know the margins are not very big anymore these days, you know, and so if you're having to cancel flights because there's just not the traffic, their revenues are going to be down. And I suppose the question is, how long can they afford for that to be the case?
Well, lots of the big airlines serving the UK, there is exactly no problem with them. I mean, they could last for, I was going to say years,
right,
certainly months without any problems. So that's EasyJet, Ryanair, Jet2, and British Airways, they are all in very, very good financial shape. They will be damaged by this, of course, but it's the smaller players who, well, just yesterday Ryanair said, oh, by the way, we're going to see some EU airlines collapse in the next few weeks. And I suspect they will be correct, because no airline was having a great time, which is why we saw, for example, Thomas Cook collapse last September. And although things have been sort of getting better, partly because Thomas Cook collapsed, there's still not huge profits being made. And if you're a small airline, cash is king, as they say, and there's no cash coming in and there's lots of it going out. So miserable time, I'm afraid.
Yes, and I mean, the other thing, of course, is one of the surprising things for me anyway, was when we discovered quite how much Chinese tourism was going on around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, one of the reasons why a lot of this spread as quickly as it did was because there were so many people from China in Europe, and it turns out now that that's not really the case. So that will also be damaging, I suppose, our own economies here in this part of the world.
Yeah, and the whole thing about big Chinese tour groups is that they tend to travel, for very good reasons of cost, off-season. And therefore, you will, generally at this time of year in the South Coast, on the Scottish Highlands, in York, in Edinburgh, in Stratford-on-Avon, there would normally be big Chinese groups who are filling up beds which would otherwise be empty. And guess what? They're not there, so those beds are empty. Mm. And yeah, they weren't being sold at huge profits, but it was still, you know, keeping people busy. They were obviously shopping and so on. So it's a real, real shame that that has that's happened. And the British tourism industry will get a boost from people staying at home. And I think, for example, Scotland will do really well out of English people thinking, well, I don't want to take the chance of going abroad. So let's go to Scotland instead. But it remains to be seen how much of that is offset by the people who aren't coming, particularly from North America. Mm. If they get the idea, oh, Britain's dangerous, not going there, or Europe's dangerous, then they have quite some previous in just saying,
well,
I
was going to say, the Americans are quite skittish about stuff like this, aren't they?
They have historically been. I mean, they would say, I guess, that we got so many wonderful things with our own country. Why would we fly long distance and take a few risks when we don't need to? So it's a dodgy time for all tourism operators. And would you believe I'm actually on a sort of one person moral crusade, which may surprise you.
That's not like you, Simon.
Which is just keep travelling. Tens of millions of jobs around the world depend on it. And if we allow ourselves, if we talk ourselves into just, staying in,
yes,
well, we're going to be in a right hole.
Well, I agree. I mean, I'm sort of constantly now, my refrain is basically that we have to be very careful that the effect of what we think is going to happen shouldn't be worse than what is actually going to happen.
Yes.
You know, in terms of the actual virus itself, you know, the Prime Minister, I think, gave a very sort of decent press conference this morning talking about how prepared we all are and how people shouldn't really worry about it. But unfortunately, you know, human nature being what it is, we're seeing people emptying supermarket shelves of hand gel and, you know, all sorts of disinfectants and all sorts of things that they think they are going to need in the case of a zombie apocalypse. And I think people just like to think of everything going horribly wrong. You know, Brexit's happened and it didn't go horribly wrong. Now we've got the coronavirus to worry about. It's a kind of human condition, it seems to me.
There's a bit of that, although I've never, ever seen anything which has caused so much upset, anxiety, stress, turning anticipation into real apprehension among travellers who are booked to go. And I'm doing all I can to say, look, this is actually a great time to be a traveller, but I'm not sure that everybody believes me. And it's one of those things where I think this has been partly fuelled by social media.
Yes.
Lots and lots of rumours going round. Once they take hold, once you get the idea that the whole world is scary, I can say till I'm blue in the face. The fact is, actually, everybody, I've done the sums. You can see my working, if you like. It has never been a safer time for British people to be holidaymakers abroad.
No.
Which is completely true. Mm. But whether anybody believes that is a different matter.
Well, I mean, you know, there are people now putting signs up in buildings saying if you've been to any of these countries, you can't come in.
I've not seen those, but how exciting.
Well, it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, you might want to be careful about where you, I mean, most of them are in sort of parts of Southeast Asia and obviously China and South Korea and Northern Italy and all of that. But certainly people are beginning to take precautions, is what I'm
saying. Well, they would call them precautions. And I'm going entirely on what the World Health Organization and what the British government say. And they basically say that travel bans, things like this, are not actually doing any good. The main thing is to contain this horrible virus is just for everybody to be better at washing their hands.
Just
practice good traveller hygiene.
I refuse to sing Happy Birthday twice. I'm not doing it.
You can.
Can I sing something else?
God Save the Queen, apparently, first verse. That's enough.
Right, that'll do. I'd rather sing that. Now, let me ask you about the story on the front of the Times today as well, which is about the fact that hotel rooms can actually cost more when you book them on these travel sites that claim to be sort of, you know, best at comparing them.
Yes, and look, guess what? It's not exactly rocket science. So, typically, a lot of people will book hotels in the following way. They may go onto a price comparison website, such as Trivago. They may then be routed to a hotel site such as Booking.com or Hotels.com.
Mm.
And then they will book this property on the grounds that, hey, look, it's the best price. And that's fine. And if you want to do that, of course, that's entirely your choice. But just remember that 18% roughly of the value of the transaction is leaving you and the proprietor of the hotel. So on a £100 room, £18 of that is just going to some investors somewhere.
Right.
And so you can do that. Or you can think, as I do, I'm just going to have a look on Trivago, see what deals there are around for, well, in fact, lovely Luxembourg. That's where I spent the weekend because they just brought in free public transport everywhere.
Great food.
Which was great. Oh, fantastic food. And fantastic that you can step on any train, bus or plane. Train, bus or tram and not spend anything anywhere in the country. All free from Saturday. They just
mind you, it is a tax haven, isn't it? So it's got lots of companies registered there.
They have got a lively financial sector, I think is the term you're looking for. So anyway, I just have a look, get an idea of prices, find one or two properties which look interesting, and I will get onto their website, or indeed, I don't know if you're familiar with this, Mike, picking up the phone and talking to them.
Well, do you know, I have been known to do that, because I did remember a time before we had the internet, and actually that was what you had to do all the time.
Yes.
But I was always under the impression as well that hotels are sort of sold a lot of their rooms to various kind of discount organisers. No. Do they not do that anymore?
That they might like to create that impression. And, of course, you get lots of urgent things saying there's only three rooms left on this or 18 people have booked in the past half hour. I would take those with a pinch of salt.
You're saying that's a bit of a con, then?
Well, I would just say that they're sending out messages which are perhaps extravagant in their claims.
Yes.
And so always contact the hotel direct because, apart from anything else, very often they'll give you a little 5% discount or something, which you quite often have to sign up for their tediously for their loyalty scheme to get, but it's worth it.
Right.
And then they'll give you extras, you know, maybe free internet, although that's pretty common everywhere now.
Right.
Maybe a free breakfast.
Still dodgy in America sometimes, the internet. And Mexico, funny enough, when I was there, you could buy internet access in this hotel that I was in Cancun one time, but you could only get it on two devices.
Yes.
Which I thought was a bit cheesy.
Would you believe, as from today, four hotels in Las Vegas have just raised their resort fee, if anybody doesn't know what these pernicious things are, in order to disguise how much hotels cost, they will add a resort fee, and in four properties in Las Vegas, you're actually going to be paying more for this extra charge, which covers things like, they say, internet and access to the health club and local phone calls.
Yes.
They've just put those prices up because of the coronavirus.
Mm.
So it's
excuse.
Yeah, exactly. Just talk direct to hotels. They will be delighted that you are helping them save 18% of the booking fee. And you'll get a better deal, I very much hope. If you don't, then let me know, because you jolly well should.
Absolutely right. Well, isn't Simon, as ever, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Simon Calder there with lots of advice about why you should continue to travel and not why you should not. Because, I mean, the problem is, of course, if the place you want to go to is not on any list of difficult countries as far as the coronavirus is concerned, there's not really any reason why you shouldn't go.
But people are kind of concerned because they're not sure if that's going to change. And they're not sure if travel in and out of this country is going to change. And that is part of the problem. It's the unknown that people fear.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Talk Radio and the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. One of the things we do here now is we do Talk Radio TV. I'm going to be filming Plank of the Week coming up later on this afternoon in the company of Andre Walker and Madeline Grant from the Daily Telegraph. Yesterday, we did what we always do on a Monday. We did the off-air show where I interview a leading personality from the world of politics or from the world of academia or sometimes from the worlds of both put together. Yesterday we spoke to Ruth Lee, who's an economist, has always been a Brexiteer, has always wanted to leave the European Union, was one of the few lone voices on that subject, but she's also quite knowledgeable on the subject of climate change. Have a listen to this.
But when it comes to global carbon emissions, we are 1%.
Yes.
One. China is knocking on for 30. Mm. Will China actually cut back on its carbon emissions because we decarbonise? No.
Of course not. Well, it's like there are people now who genuinely walk around going, oh, it's OK, I've planted some trees. And you go, well, so?
So?
What difference does that make? I mean, my favourite story is about Chris Martin, the Coldplay singer, who decided to offset their last tour by putting 40,000 trees in a very hot part of southern India. Half of them burnt down and the other half died because there wasn't enough water to keep them going. And you go, well, that's really not helping at all, is it?
You can get the whole of that off-air conversation on YouTube just by typing Talk Radio. By the way, you can also watch this particular show every single day. We live stream it on YouTube, we live stream it on Facebook and Twitter. Just go to the YouTube channel, like it, subscribe to it, and then every time we do anything, you will get an alert for something else that you can watch. And more people are joining the channel, more and more people are looking forward to it every single week. So we'll do more of that as the week goes on. And as I say, look out for Plank of the Week later on this evening. Right now, though, we're going to talk to Matt Vickers, Conservative MP for Stockton South. We spoke to Matt some weeks ago when he was a new boy, as it were, in Parliament. He was one of those Tory MPs elected from the northeast of England, and he'd come to London really not knowing what to expect. But we're going to talk to him now about how MPs are apparently more likely to booze than the rest of us. Matt, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Now, the last time you were here, you were telling us that you were quite shocked at the price of beer in London. So I don't know whether you've got more used to that. But I suppose what I can say is that MPs that I know now probably drink a lot less than they used to about 20 years ago.
I think that might be the case. They're obviously having a very good time all that time ago. I think this issue about people drinking, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, to hear people so worried about the well-being of MPs all of a sudden. But I think, I mean, alcoholism and mental health issues, they're very serious issues, there's lots of consequences, they're a big deal. But I think most MPs are responsible enough to look after themselves, I would hope.
Yes, you would think. But one of the things, funny enough, I was down there just during half term. I took my kids around the Parliament, and a friend of mine was kind enough to show me around. And what I didn't realise was that an awful lot of the bars have actually been shut down. Because there used to be, I think, about 18 or 19 bars in the Palace of Westminster, and I think they've reduced it down to by half.
I'm not sure of that. There's still plenty of places to find a drink, I can tell you that. I think one of the things with this debate is we oversimplify the issue. We sort of demonise beer and pubs. Actually, they're, you know, sensible, moderate, sociable drinking is good for people's mental health.
Yeah.
It's good for tackling isolation. It's got benefits to the economy, the industry. You know, like, we oversimplify it. We talk about pubs and beer being a bad thing. Actually, they're a really good thing in villages throughout the country. In places like this, the big decisions that are made here aren't made because someone stands up in the chamber and shouts about them. They're made by discussions that go on around coffee tables or perhaps with a pint in
hand. Sometimes in the bar. Yeah, I was slightly concerned to find out that the press bar had shut down and that the guy who used to run it, who everybody knew terribly well, because when I was a newspaper executive, I used to pop down there sometimes of a, say, Tuesday or Wednesday night. And as long as there was the Parliament was in session, the bar was always open. And apparently the press bar's gone. It was one of the ones sort of up at the top of one of the towers. And so I don't know how many of the bars you've visited so far on your travels.
The problem with that is they might have shut this press bar. It means you lot get in with us. That's the problem.
Well, that is a problem, and that means you can't say anything to each other without getting found out, I suppose.
But that might help moderate the drinking, though.
Yeah, it might well do. What's the going rate now for a pint of beer in Parliament?
You know, that's a good question. It's like one of those bottle of milk questions.
Yeah, it's a big. I think the last time I bought a pint in there, which was quite a few years ago, it was a quid or so cheaper than it would be on the outside.
You bought an individual pie. Did you not buy them round, Mike?
Well, I did, yeah. But I'm just trying. I'm just trying to help you along with your lack of knowledge. I'm just trying to be nice here because you know I don't want you to get caught out in a bad way. But yeah, no, it was. I think if a pint was £4 outside, it was £3 in there or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm not sure.
They're keeping it in line with us Northerners, I think. That's the thing.
Well, that's exactly right. So how are you settling in anyway? Have you found your way around the most of it now?
I'm loving it. I think I found all the bars. I'm absolutely loving it. We've been banging some questions in today. There's a maiden speech on the horizon. I'm absolutely loving it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interestingly enough, I was listening to somebody talk the other day saying that there's a certain news organisation which is a bit unhappy at the moment because they hired a load of extra people to do more politics. And they're finding that they haven't got anything to cover because it's so boring. Because there's nobody fighting anymore because you guys have got such a big majority that there's literally nothing going on.
You mean we're busy getting things done?
Well, there is that. I mean, yeah. you would say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what's your sort of, you know, take on the Northern Powerhouse scenario? Because when you were in here, you were saying you've got to make sure that you do deliver for the people that got you into Parliament. So how's that coming along?
I'm quite happy. We've got a very intelligent bloke at number 11 now, and I think he's going to do a very good job for us.
Yeah.
And he represents the Northern constituency, which can only be very good news.
He's a big fan of Yorkshire tea.
He is. that's gone down very well, hasn't it?
It has,
We've got Tetley Tea in my constituency. I don't know if I'll demonise him by mentioning them. but Tetley Tea, I don't know. What's your brew of choice, Mike?
Do you know what? I don't know. I mean, I'll just drink any old tea. I don't really mind.
All right, not fussy.
You know, I'm not a tea snob. I do quite like the old Earl Grey, I have to say.
Yeah.
Mm. So what's on the agenda for the rest of this week? Because we just had Boris Johnson on the coronavirus. Obviously, that's the thing that's kind of occupying everybody's mind at the moment because nobody really knows where it's all going to go. But what's your sort of rest of your week looking like?
I'm heading back to the constituency on Thursday. Yeah. And I've got loads of stuff to do. I'm going to meet the chief constable. We've got all sorts of issues.
Good. Of
things to tackle. And in fact, the biggest thing today, the biggest news on the horizon, I don't know whether it's been released yet, but we're connecting up 1,000 more houses to super fast broadband.
Oh, brilliant.
Not this week. In my constituency, 1,000 more people, 1,000 more kids able to study at home with super fast broadband, 1,000 more people able to set up a business in the constituency. Great stuff.
So great. So tell us the constituency. You might as well take the credit for it.
Stockton South. We're solving rural problems. We're hooking people up with broadband. We've got another amazing thing. One of the problems in rural areas is about buses.
Yeah.
And the fact that bus companies do not want to run empty buses through villages because it costs a bit of cash. Yeah. And it's no use to anybody if the bus is empty. We've got this innovative approach in Teesside where we've got these fantastic... It's Teesflex. It's like the Uber bus.
Oh, yeah.
It's an Uber bus. You go on, you get your app, or you ring up and you say, you know, Mrs. Jones wants the bus and wants to go to the doctor's at 2 o'clock this afternoon. We hook it all in. This bus system, then the buses run on demand.
That's a good idea.
The village. Yeah, they're innovative. We'll see if it works. I think it will work. It will work. I'm positive and upbeat about it.
Well, it's about using technology to help the community, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Sounds... doing what you always did. If it didn't work before, it's not going to work now. So think outside the box.
To tell that to the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks very much indeed. Matt Vickers there. What a great guy. Conservative MP for Stockton South, already making a difference. There you are. If you live in Stockton South, you're getting faster broadband, you're getting a sort of DIY bus service, custom made, to get you around and about. I think those are the kind of MPs we need. And I'm a great supporter of the new breed of young MP, who have won their seats in the north of England, unexpectedly, you'd have to say, but much built on the back of Boris's Brexit plan. And it can only be a good thing. It can only be encouraging, not only that people like Matt are doing things for his local community and doing things for his constituency, but he's willing to come on this radio station and talk about it as well. So hats off to Matt, and no wonder the bars are brewing lots and lots of beer down in Westminster, and I'm sure there'll be lots of reasons to celebrate. We shall see.
Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.